This is a Silver Bullet Security Podcast with Gary McGraw. I'm your host, Gary McGraw, CTO of Sigital and author of Software Security. This podcast series is co-sponsored by Sigital and IEEE Security and Privacy Magazine. For more, see www.computer.org/security and www.sigital.com/silverbullet. This is the 123rd in a series of interviews with security gurus, and I'm pleased to have with me today Yannick Korf. Hi, Yannick.
Hey, Gary.
I've known Yannick for a long time. Yannick Korf is currently a consultant for Korf Consulting, LLC. He's also the owner. Yannick was previously the vice president of the Mandiant Computer Incident Response Team. He's also worked at AOL as the leader of the security engineering team at Bell Atlantic and also at Sigital a million years ago. Yannick has a decade or more of experience in security operations, development, and infrastructure. He also established AOL's PKI. We served together on the advisory board of Intrepid. And Yannick has a BS in computer science from the College of William & Mary and an MS in MIS from University of Virginia. He lives in Virginia with his family, but he's in California today. Hi, Yannick.
How are you doing?
I'm good. I hope your trip out there wasn't too bad.
It was pretty uneventful. It was a bit of a last-minute trip, so I caught the much-wanted middle seat, but I survived.
Oh, you lucky guy, and probably on United, too, huh?
Absolutely. My favorite airline.
I think they're beginning to realize that they suck, which is, you know, the first step towards not doing that.
I actually ended up needing to call support due to some IT issues, but that turned out to be a pleasant experience, and I was shocked.
Cool. Well, you started out, speaking of pleasant experiences, as a system administrator. then you did security ops and ended up as an executive in charge of services around network ops and incident response. So, you know, in this career that's kind of gone, you know, you've been doing this for about 20 years. What's the most important thing that you learned about security or about, you know, working in the field?
Most important thing I learned is probably, gosh, can I say this without sounding corny? It's about the people.
That's not,
you know,
so
the technology
corny.
Works for a limited amount of time, and if the people can't adapt and throw out the old technology and bring in new stuff and change, it all falls apart.
But I thought, you know, system administrator people just didn't like those darn pesky users.
Oh, I still don't.
But they're people, Yannick. Come on.
They are. I have a love-hate relationship with people. It's hard to explain.
So it's about the people. How about, you know, coming up through having to use other people's operating systems and stuff and gear through monitoring for security and handling incidents, you know, was there anything that struck you as something that was counterintuitive that you learned?
You know, I think one of the big turning points for me actually, funnily enough, happened at Sigital. We were putting in a new firewall and really struggling with it. Things were not flowing past it. I was green. I didn't know how to troubleshoot any of this stuff. I was working with a more senior guy. And eventually we sort of ran out of ideas. So I called my boss, talked him through, you know, everything we'd done, all of our ideas. And he said one thing I will never forget that really helped us out. He said, "Well, good luck." That was it. That was all the guidance we got.
So you learned that you can use that magic catchphrase as an executive? Is that what you're saying?
No. The thing I learned there was, you know, when you're stuck and you can't pass the buck, but you got to make something work, you figure it out.
Yeah.
And if you keep, you know, answering other people's questions, just, you know, here's the answer, and they don't need to work for it, they grow a lot less. Mm-hmm. So that was super, super valuable. I don't know if that was the intended lesson, but that's the one I took away.
Was that Scott Marks?
That was, yeah.
It probably wasn't really the intended answer. It was probably beer 30.
it was probably 11:30, I think, at night when we were at that point.
That's hilarious. Let's talk about socks and certs for a minute. So how much of a sock and cert is people versus automation these days?
I think that's pretty highly variable, and it really depends on what you're trying to do and the kind of SOC you're trying to build. So I built a managed security service, so that's naturally going to be multi-tenant, and it depends on what you're trying to slice. So we always looked at things pretty much from a threat-centric perspective. If you've got opportunistic threats that are on your network and consuming your IT team's time, that's one problem.
Mm-hmm.
If you've got targeted threats who are very interested in your company's intellectual property or want to commit fraud, that's a different scenario. The latter is a lot more people-intensive than the former. But I think if you look at, you know, the managed security space today,
yeah,
you'll find they're really applying people to technology problems in a lot of cases. So I've been kind of disappointed to the way that that space has been evolving.
In a sense that the automation isn't what it could be. We still need the people,
really,
but automation needs to be improved.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. What do you think? Are companies better off running their own SOC or outsourcing or some combo package, or it depends, or what? What's the answer to that?
So if you look at the, we'll call them the security one percenters, the guys who have massive security budgets and have somehow an access to security talent that's relatively unlimited,
mm-hmm.
Sure. You can buy the right pieces of the technology. You can put them together and grow your own security operations center.
Mm-hmm.
And most importantly, if you can provide interesting bad guy stuff on your network all the time, then you can even retain those people.
Right, right.
Because security people really need a constant stream of entertainment, which most companies refer to as bad news.
So outsourcers get better people because it's less boring.
It's tremendously less boring. I'd talk to, you know, new employees back at Mandiant, you know, 90 days after they had started, and consistently would hear, man, I have learned more here in the last 3 months than I did in the last 3 years at my last job.
Yeah, we hear that too. Of course, we're not really in operations, so there's always stuff to do in security engineering because you're building new things. Software security is different that way. But operations is just as important, and it does get boring. You know, if nothing happens, you've done your job. And ironically, if nothing happens and you go and ask for an increase in budget, they tell you that nothing happened and they cut it.
Well, that's the funny thing about systems administration where I came from, right? It's if you're doing a great job, nobody notices you. But if you're not doing a great job, everybody notices you for the wrong reason.
Hard to be right.
Yeah, it's a no-win.
Yeah. What do you think we've learned over the years from incident response in terms of computer security?
I hope that we have learned, and this may not be exactly what you're asking, but I hope we have learned that one response does not fit all.
Ah.
For a long time, we worked with customers who believed, you know, you detect and you reimage the machine, and that is incident response. Like, that is the process.
Yep.
Just
clean up the mud puddle and keep on going.
Exactly. And it took tremendous amounts of time and education to get people around to the idea that, no, maybe instead we can ask some questions about how that got there, figure out if it's anywhere else, and then come up with a more comprehensive plan, depending on what we're dealing with. You know, in the case of those targeted attacks, sure, if it's an opportunistic one, yeah, clean it up, whatever, you're going to get another one. But,
yep.
You know, in a month or so, take a look at the last month's worth of data and go find some root causes for that and address it. So I think I see more companies out there that are taking that kind of an approach,
mm-hmm.
or at least are open-minded in that direction. So I'm
yep.
cautiously optimistic that we're headed in a good place.
I think you're right about that. And I think that actually informs things like software security, which are in some sense even more proactive. You know, if you wonder, why would you bother to build a system that's more secure anyway? Well, if you've been through the incident wars, you know why.
Yeah, so. That's definitely true. I mean, your initial vector for the guys, the true bad guys, tend to be the people with whom I may have mentioned I have a love-hate relationship. But once you get
you can never really get a system administrator turned around on that, can you?
No, you really can't. It runs deep. But yeah, once you get past that first person as your vector, from there it's system to system. And, you know, taking advantage of software vulnerabilities is a great way to move around.
Yeah. So now that you've developed pointy hair and some management chops, let's talk about people a little bit more. When you're hiring for your team, what's the most important characteristic you look for, and how do you look for it?
You know, the corny answer, I guess, here is it depends on what team and what characteristics I'm looking for the people on that team.
Mm-hmm. So pick one and make it concrete.
Let's stick with the topic. So let's talk about a security analyst. And let's say that the security analysts I want are going to be dealing with targeted attacks, not opportunistic ones. If that's true, then I need curiosity, first and foremost, because when you see something that's weird, you need to look at that and say, huh, that's interesting. I wonder, and then they're going to want to take some action.
Right.
And then beyond that sort of base curiosity is like a level of persistence where you just really don't like unsolved mysteries. It's sort of intolerable. And you're creative, which means you adapt to different situations. So those three are probably the top ones for that kind of a role.
Okay.
We've made mistakes at hiring folks who are more process-oriented. They like to know what the next step is, and that didn't work. Like very directly did not work in that kind of environment.
Right, so more of an engineer and less of a creative type,
yep.
Say. So how do you find people like that? You know, in some sense, interviewing's like going on one date and deciding whether to get married, which is always a weird thing.
Yeah, it's certainly hard. And I have yet to hear of anybody with, you know, 100% success rate. But we did have a pattern we followed when it came to hiring. And it really stemmed down to, you know, asking people to tell you about themselves. Like, tell me your story, where you came from, what you did, and all the changes that you went through. Why did you do that? Mm-hmm. What prompted you to go from one job to another? What was not interesting about the last one, more interesting about the next one? And through that story, you end up getting most of your questions answered, I've found.
Mm-hmm.
You'll find the folks who are like, yeah, you know, I learned a whole bunch of stuff there, and I felt like I'd sort of mastered that, and I got this other opportunity. I was talking to a buddy of mine, and they had this problem, and they hadn't figured out how to solve it yet, and I thought that was really interesting, so I went over there, and you'll feel that enthusiasm come through.
Right, so you're looking for passion, you're looking for enthusiasm, and it's okay if somebody moves on to, say, something more interesting. As long as you're a manager, you can make sure they always have something interesting in front of their nose if you're doing it right.
Yeah, and frankly, I'm not... and this is a little bit unpopular, but I'm not hell-bent on keeping people forever. You know, I've changed jobs.
Yep.
I don't want people to be stuck in a job that they don't like. I had an employee years ago who came to me and said, I don't like my job.
Say, okay,
go
get a new
beginning
one.
Beginning of our one-on-one. So, I mean, you know, kudos to her. That's a ballsy thing to do.
Right.
We had a really good conversation, sort of figured out what the issues were, and they were issues that I was not going to be able to fix for at least 2 years between the shape of the business. And so I was fully supportive when she, you know, she changed jobs. I was very sad to see her go, but happy that she was moving into something that she enjoyed.
Yeah. And in some sense, if you're going to change the world, like I've been trying to do in software security, you got to expect people to go out and to grow past your organization sometimes. And as long as they leave and they're happy with their experiences in the past, they can help spread the good ideas that they might have accidentally caught while they were working at your place. We'll be right back after this message. If you like what you're hearing on Silver Bullet, make sure to check out my other projects on GaryMcGraw.com. There you can find writings, videos, and even original music. So, from a technical team member perspective, what's more important, technical skill or motivation?
There's a strong temptation for me to say the motivation, because that's what's going to drive you. But you've got to be able to hit the ground running to earn the credibility of your peers.
Yep.
So there is a baseline from a technical skill perspective that you just can't get around.
Very well put. So you got to have both. You can't just be utterly motivated and clueless.
No, you've got to have some skills to bear. And you've got to understand where you are. You need to be very self-aware about where you are on that chain of expertise.
So in terms of management skills, there's this one skill that I like a lot that works incredibly well against geeks, and that's silence. Do you use that?
yeah, probably inadvertently. As someone who both likes and dislikes people, I don't necessarily enjoy keeping up my end of the conversation. So if I have nothing to say, I won't say anything.
You're doing pretty well so far.
that tends to move things along.
Right. So, well, silence is often an uncomfortable social situation, so people will talk right into the gap, I guess.
Yep.
And that's a good way of learning what somebody's really thinking. or getting past the initial spin or whatever.
Especially if you don't know where the conversation's headed.
Yeah. So in some of your writing, you talk about core values. And, you know, in some sense, when you're looking for employees, you want certain set of core values: motivation, self-driven, curiosity, likes to solve puzzles, get stuff done. You know, those are all core values. Do you think that universities that produce geeks are instilling core values like that, or can you teach those, or where do those come from?
Man, that's a good question. I don't think it has anything to do with what you're taught. I think it has a lot more to do with who you're around and who you interact with. Because everybody, I perceive, everybody models somebody else. I mean, you find those people to look up to, and you take the best of the people around you. And so that's where those come about.
So there might be some people to emulate in a university setting, but that's just an accident of the people, not really the setting.
Yeah, I think that's accurate.
Okay. So really you should, I guess especially in graduate students, in graduate school, I take this view as well. Look for the person you want to study with, not the university, and the person matters more. I've always thought that for grad school. I'm not so sure that you can do that in undergrad, though.
That's a really good question. I think you're unlikely to really be able to assess before you go into any kind of institution the kind of people you're going to be with. That's tough. I mean, there's campus visits, and sometimes you can visit classrooms and stuff, but you don't really get to know people until you spend a lot of time with them, right? You asked earlier about the interview process, and you get this short date before you've got this long marriage.
Yeah.
It's similar. So
right.
In many cases, I'm going to say that's luck of the draw.
Yep. Yeah, I'm just going through that with my youngest son who, you know, picked which college to attend through some mysterious process that neither his mother nor I understand. And hopefully it'll work out. It worked out for the first one, but it also seemed less mysterious for that one than the second one.
Yeah, I've got a little time yet, so.
Yep, it's on my mind a little bit. So I've noticed in some of my really recent work, like stuff I did Tuesday, that technologists who go from alpha geek into management suffer from this thing that we'll call the Superman syndrome, where they sort of want to tackle the hardest problem themselves. Let me think of an example. For example, a CISO who does his or own threat intelligence gathering like every morning because they don't want somebody else to do that. So as a manager and as a geek yourself, as an alpha geek, how do you avoid the Superman syndrome? What kind of advice can you give to our listeners about that?
You know, I got really lucky. I had that problem when I first took on management. It was a slightly different flavor, but I went from, you know, being on a team to managing that same team. So I knew what we did. I knew the work. I could do the work. And I was relatively well-respected in the team.
Mm-hmm.
And as soon as I became the manager, I became the go-to guy for everybody on the team whenever there was a problem.
Right.
How do we fix it?
Yep.
You know, how do I solve this? What's the right way to build that?
Yep.
And, you know, thinking I was helpful, I would answer those questions.
Mm-hmm. This goes with your earlier answer. Very nice.
I know. Completely forgetting the lesson from Scott Marks.
Yep.
I struggled. And everything actually went well. It was deceptive. I thought, well, this is going great. We're getting a bunch of stuff done. Everybody was happy. And then I went on vacation.
Well, there's your mistake.
Well, that's a fair point.
What happened? Tell more.
Nothing. Nothing happened. I mean, I came back, and there was a line of people outside of my door. All the projects were stalled. Stuff was broken. I had created this dependence that really didn't need to be there. I mean, those folks were smart folks. They could have done all of what was required without me there, but
right.
I sort of created this bad habit.
Right. So this Superman syndrome is something you've seen in your own work.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, we saw this at I'm working with a bunch of CISOs, and I see some super technical CISOs where that becomes an issue. And it's hard to, you know, not want to take over if you're sort of a control freak alpha geek. So what do you do besides just self-realization? Are there any techniques for not doing that?
I said earlier I was lucky. The luckiest part for me was we had a sister team at the time. So I was running a team of system administrators. We had a sister team of developers. And the boss of the development team with whom I had started a pretty difficult relationship, but it became a really good relationship, he left the company.
Mm-hmm.
And at the time he left, he said, you know, my team of developers, they've got a lot of experience. I don't know anybody else in this organization who could run this team. You're going to have to hire for it. Or you could just give it to Yana because he knows all those guys. And I think that would work well.
Mm-hmm.
And all of a sudden I went to doubling my team from, you know, 8 to 16 people, which is wholly unreasonable.
Yeah. I mean, it's a pretty big difference, right?
Yeah, it's very different. And so I had to immediately shift my priorities from one team's mission to two teams' mission and begin to start thinking about structures that would help me run both of those teams.
Right.
The answers were not obvious, and it consumed all of my time because at the time I still didn't have a ton of management experience.
Yep.
And I had no choice. There was literally, I could not be the answer giver.
Talk about getting thrown in the pool. Here, swim.
Exactly. And what happened is the team survived. You know, they realized, well, gosh, he's really busy with this other thing right now. I can't do that. Let me see if I can figure this out. And that's really all they needed.
Right. Was to get, so to be weaned. They, in some sense, weaned themselves through necessity.
Yeah.
Is there a similar switch between, say, managing 16 people or two teams up to 50? I think you had 50 when you were, you know, finishing up over at Mandiant.
Yeah, there were probably, I think by the time I left FireEye, it was closer to 100.
Okay.
But that was, you know, a little bit after the acquisition.
Right.
Is there a difference? I think you take a lot of the lessons with you as you go. I know a lot of folks who have jumped management rungs, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm glad I didn't. It's a lot harder to do it the slow way, I think, but you learn a lot better lessons along the way. You have the time to make the mistakes that will sit with you for a long time. And
you may have a mentor above you who can teach you some of those things too, right?
Rare,
but
yeah, that's
if you
possible.
Do it the long way, it's presumably you're learning the whole time.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
So is, you know, if you had to characterize the difference in running 100 people versus, say, running that first team of 8 that you did 10 years ago, what would that be?
I don't know that I have a crisp answer. It really depends on the shape of the team and the people. At the end of the day, you're still running a team of people.
Yep.
It's just a question of whether they're managing people themselves or not.
Mm-hmm.
But your job is still to develop a high-trust one-on-one relationship, understand what their challenges are, and coach them through it, without solving their problems for them and helping them grow. I mean, whether you're doing that to somebody who has direct reports or not direct reports, you're doing the same thing. You're just dealing with different problems.
Right. Did they ever send you off to management school?
No. At some point,
I mean, you already had an MS, right? So you'd been to business school in some sense.
Yeah, I did that later on. But they don't teach you anything about management in business school, as far as I could I could determine, at least the school I went to. It was more about, you know, building a business and understanding the financials and strategy and all that jazz.
All right.
But actually managing people. Now, actually, I stumbled upon, I had a good mentor at AOL for a while, just a really great sounding board. And then I stumbled upon an organization called Manager Tools that...
Yeah.
Interestingly enough, also does a bunch of podcasts.
Was that Doug Bigelow?
No, Doug Bigelow did run the organization at AOL, but the mentor was Lavenna. Doug was pretty ill when I started.
Oh, he was up higher too, I guess.
Yeah, he was Lavenna's boss.
Yeah, he was very good. His legacy is still around in a bunch of people that I know in the field. It's very interesting.
Yeah, he really had a good attitude. I remember I talked to him early on at my role there as I was moving into a management role, and he said, you know, whatever you love about the technical work, people are going to tell you need to let that go. I'm going to tell you don't. Hold on to it and make them pry it out of your hands, you know, your cold dead fingers.
Wait a minute. Now you're getting me confused about the Superman syndrome. What are you saying?
Hey, I never promised I would make any sense or be coherent.
Well, we better quit then. It's been about half an hour. So, last question, which has nothing to do with anything. So you've had a huge fish tank for many years. What's your favorite creature, and how big is your current tank?
Oh, man. So the tank, which is the easier question, is 300 gallons.
Holy cow.
That's the main display tank. Then you've got, you know, the filtration system underneath it, which is probably another 100 gallons, and the refugium, which keeps an environment without predation, which is probably another 20 gallons. And then I've got the back room where I've got a water reservoir. So all told, there's a bunch of water involved.
But you just tell your wife it's 300 gallons, huh? Is that how that works?
That's pretty much how that works.
Okay. Well, what's your favorite creature in the pile?
You know, generally speaking, I think my favorite set of creatures are corals. I'm not in it for the fish. The corals I find way more fascinating.
Yeah.
They have this weird symbiotic relationship with algae that live inside their bodies.
Mm-hmm.
They're kind of immortal. I mean, they just keep growing and splitting and growing, and you got to work to kill them.
Do you dive?
You know, I don't do scuba diving. I desperately want to find time to go do that.
Oh, you gotta. Yeah, I just got certified this spring because my son Eli's been diving for 5 years, and he finally just dragged me along with his mother's also certified. And wow, is it cool. Definitely do it.
Yeah, I saw you went on your trip, and you got that certification a little while ago, and I was envious without a doubt.
Well, just do it.
Just do it. I'm very busy.
Dude, you work for Korf Consulting. Give yourself some sort of project in, you know, St. Croix.
Yeah, I totally should do that.
Well, thanks, Yannick. It's been interesting talking to you. Appreciate your insights.
Yeah, you bet.
This has been a Silver Bullet Security Podcast with Gary McGraw. Silver Bullet is co-sponsored by Cigital and IEEE Security and Privacy Magazine and syndicated by Search Security. The May-June issue of IEEE S&P focuses on the economics of cybersecurity. It also features our interview with Jacob West, in which we discuss the IEEE Center for Secure Design. Check out the video we shot to celebrate episode 120, 10 years of the Silver Bullet Security Podcast, and it includes drones. Show links, notes, and an online discussion can be found on the Silver Bullet webpage at www.sigil.com/silverbullet. This is Gary McGraw.